Support for WPR comes from Stone Harbor, a Door County resort and conference center overlooking the historic Steel Bridge in Sturgeon Bay. Details about hosting a wedding or conference are at stoneharbor-resort.com.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
One of Wisconsin Public Radio's most prominent amassers of books, Steve Paulson, joins us now to share some of the best reads that he's come across lately. Steve is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's with us here in studio. Steve, thanks for coming by again.
Oh, it is always a pleasure.
Well, we're going to start out with Lori Moore, maybe the most celebrated short story writer of our time. She used to belong to Wisconsin entirely. She taught at the UW-Madison, but now we have to share her. She's got a new collection out. Can you tell us what she's written?
Yes, it's a collection of short stories called Bark, which is her first collection of short stories in 15 years. So this is a literary event. And as you were saying, Lori Moore was a mainstay of writing here in Wisconsin, taught for many years at the UW, and has since recently moved to Nashville, where she's now teaching, and Vanderbilt. And this is a collection of stories. Most of the stories are dealing with characters kind of in middle age. It's sort of bittersweet relationships, and it has the trademark Lori Moore style. I mean, she has a very distinctive style. Her voice is
witty.
You would recognize it anywhere. Well, it's sort of this. It's this combination of funny and awful. And I mean, that's the thing that's sort of amazing about her. And so she manages to bring humor into anxieties, into misery, and often within the same paragraph or even the same sentence. I mean, that's the thing that I think sort of jumps out at you about her writing.
And you interviewed her recently, right?
I did, yes. And
was she in studio?
She was in studio, yes.
Back in Wisconsin for a while. Well, you brought along a clip for us to listen to from that interview. Do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. So this is reading from the very beginning of the first story in the book. And it's about a guy named Ira, who is down in his luck, recently divorced, and he is reflecting on how his life has turned out. So let's listen.
Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. His finger had swelled dully around it, a combination of frustrated desire, unmitigated remorse, and misdirected ambition, he said to friends. I'm going to have my entire finger surgically removed. Maybe I should cut off the whole hand and send it to her, he said on the phone to his friend Mike, with whom he worked at the State Historical Society. You'll remove that ring when you're ready, Mike said now. Here's what you do for your depression. I'm not going to say lose yourself in charity work. I'm going to say this. Stop drinking, stop smoking, eliminate coffee, sugar, dairy products. Do this for 3 days and start everything back up again. Bam. I guarantee you, you will be so happy. I'm afraid, Ira said softly, that the only thing that would make me happy right now is snipping the brake cables on Marilyn's car.
That is a great example. Right. And I love how the friend tells him to give up smoking and dairy. Right.
So you don't know whether to laugh or to cry, right, when you hear these stories. And that is what makes Lori Moore such a great writer.
Oh, that's a fabulous one. And anything else you want to say about her, about this collection? That was one of the stories.
Yeah. Well, she even has a ghost story in this collection called Juniper Tree. But it's not really scary. And so there's this person who, this friend of the narrator of the story who has just died, but is still kind of hanging around. The dead woman is, and sort of comes back and visits and tells the narrator kind of various ways that she has fallen short in her life. And so, for Lori, it's a way of ghost stories, I think, are a sort of, you know, you can explore interesting psychological terrain there.
Did you ask her why she took so long? 15 years. That's a long time between short story collections.
Yeah. Well, she did write a novel a few years ago. So, right. And she's a teacher, and
she's
so
busy.
You know, busy life.
Yeah. Gotcha. So we're going to move along now to a different kind, a different genre. This is a writer that you say is being hailed as the modern Proust. Who's he?
In some circles, yes. He's a Norwegian writer named Karl Ove Knausgård, and he is involved in this remarkable writing project right now. See, he is. He's come out with a series of books, six in all, which are basically his life story. I mean, it's memoir, except for he bills it as fiction, except for it's extremely autobiographical. And it's warts and all. He is sort of telling everything, the goriest details about his life, about his family's life. And this has been a phenomenon, not just in his native Norway, but throughout Europe. He is being hailed as sort of the hottest thing since sliced bread or whatever one has in Norway. And apparently it's so popular in Norway, some businesses have said, you know, we need Knausgård free days, because all anyone wanted to do when a new book of his came out is just to talk about these stories and to rehash them in a way. And do you want a taste of one?
Yeah, let's hear what people are so nuts about.
So he is, he sort of has this Scandinavian angst about him. And so this is a passage from his first novel. So one thing I should say is, so the six volumes have come out in Norway and throughout Europe. They're being translated in this country, and two have been published here, and the third is about to come out. So this is a passage from the first volume. He says, "Joy is not my goal, never has been. What good is joy to me? The family is not my goal either. If it had been, and I could have devoted all my energy to it, we would have had a fantastic time, of that I am sure. We could have lived somewhere in Norway, gone skiing and skating in winter with packed lunches and a thermos flask in our backpacks, and boating in the summer, swimming, fishing, camping, holidays abroad with our families. We could have kept the house tidy, spent time making good food, being with our friends. We could have been blissfully happy. That may all sound like a caricature, but every day I see families who successfully organize their lives in this way." And then jumping ahead a bit, he goes on to say, "The question of happiness is banal, but the question that follows is not, the question of meaning. When I look at a beautiful painting, I have tears in my eyes, but not when I look at my children. That does not mean I do not love them, because I do, with all my heart. It simply means that the meaning they produce is not sufficient to fulfill a whole life. Not mine, at any rate. Soon I will be 40. And when I'm 40, it won't be long before I'm 50. And when I'm 50, it won't be long before I'm 60. And when I'm 60, it won't be long before I'm 70. And that will be that. My epitaph might read, 'Here lies a man who grinned and bore it. And in the end, he perished for it.'"
He sounds like a cheery fellow.
Yes.
And this is what's taking Norway and Europe and maybe America by storm.
It is hugely popular and very controversial, as it turns out, for a couple of reasons. One is he is spilling all the nitty-gritty details of his life, his family's life. It's a lot of these books are about his very troubled relationship with his father, who is stern, a disciplinarian, kind of abusive, and ends up dying an alcoholic. And his father's family was furious when these came out. Apparently, they have stopped talking to him. And then the other reason why it is very controversial is he has called this book My Struggle, Min Kamp, in Norwegian, a play on Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
And, and it's his struggle in his own way. And I think he was deliberately courting controversy. Now, there's nothing, about nationalism or fascism or anything like that. But he is deliberately being provocative in these stories.
Now, have you made it through volumes one and two?
I have not yet. I'm still working on volume one. But it's kind of curiously addictive, because you have these long passages where he's talking about the most sort of the minutiae of life. I mean, a lot of it is the teenage years. I mean, there's one whole long section where he goes on for pages and pages on how he and a buddy, when they're about 15, they're trying to figure out how to sneak a case of alcohol to a party without his father seeing it. And so you have these kind of passages, and then you have these sort of transcendent passages where he's just sort of reflecting on life. And so it's pretty remarkable.
We'll have to see if it catches on with the American psyche the way it has with the European
right.
and the Scandinavian. Well, before we run out of time, you've got a third book for us. This is in the realm of science. This one called About Time.
Right, by Adam Frank, who is an astrophysicist. And the reason I thought about this is, there was that news last week of this remarkable discovery that apparently astrophysicists have sort of detected the ripples from the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. And Adam Frank is writing about the Big Bang. But, I mean, the thing to realize about the Big Bang is, this, it's it goes back to maybe a millionth or a billionth of a second after the moment of creation. It doesn't actually go back to creation itself. And no one knows what happened back then. You know, was there just a single universe? Were there multiple universes? So there's this huge controversy about that. And Adam Frank's point is that our theories about cosmology are very much tied into our theories about time. So if you go, for instance, to the Middle Ages, that's when our notion of hours popped up. And then a little bit later, you have Isaac Newton talking about the clockwork universe, you know, as if the universe was like machine parts. And this was right at the time of the Industrial Revolution. And then skip ahead later on to the end of the 19th century. You have, this is the time when the train has suddenly sort of totally transformed our life and our sense of time, because then suddenly what 3:05 meant in New York had to be the same as 3:05 in Philadelphia, because the trains had to...
It really takes you through the sweep of history.
Yes, exactly.
And does it in the end change the way you think about time?
It raises interesting questions. Now we're in the era of the millisecond. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, there's this race to develop the quantum computer, which would totally radically re-engineer our notions of time. So anyway, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Excellent. So lots of three great picks there. Steve, thanks so much for coming by and sharing these with us again.
It's always a pleasure.
We've been talking with executive producer of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge, also, as you see, a prodigious reader.